The English Eccentric by E. O. Higgins.
In 1765, a distinguished French scholar by the name of Pierre-Jean Grosley visited England for the first time and was struck by the level of eccentricity he observed in the natives. Writing home on the subject, he noted that this unusual behaviour he had observed could be attributed to a mixture of fogs, beef, and beer, aggravated by the tedium of the English Sunday. And this was years before anyone had even invented songs of praise. But what is eccentricity? Eccentricity is that sort of behaviour in individuals that is considered odd, unusual, or quirky. It describes an often unintentional breaking away or dismissal of the social norms, to pursue avenues in life that are often considered beyond normal priorities. But there's always something fairly benign in the motives of the true eccentric. Otherwise, any old serial killer could make the list. The eccentrics we'll meet in this podcast series are often people with corkscrew minds, peculiar obsessions, and largely incomprehensible outlooks. They straddle the sexes and all social classes. Some of their stories are famous, but most are unjustifiably obscure. But hopefully, what they all are is worth a listen.
Anthony William Hall, 1898-1947. The man who would not be king.
On the 1st of February 1931, an official-looking letter arrived on the desk of Sir Clive Wigram, the private secretary to King George V. Curiously, the missive bore the seal of the Royal House of Tudor, and was labelled by Royal Command. Though the letter was evidently intended for the King, the sender chose to omit his royal title, plumping instead for the markedly more casual George Frederick Albert Ernest Windsor, Esquire. Breaking the letter's seal open, Sir Clive removed a small, elegant letter, written on fine parchment, and saw that it was signed off, rather mysteriously, by King Anthony I. Though the letter was short, its contents were hugely inflammatory. King Anthony stated that he was claiming the throne of England, and also damned the present occupant as a usurper. Not only that, but King Anthony concluded that if the present incumbent didn't relinquish his own claim forthwith, he should face transportation. For the next two decades, the British establishment was beset by letters of a similar type, all from the would-be monarch, King Anthony I. demanding to take his rightful place as Britain's true sovereign. Though suspecting King Anthony to be simply on the make, he was nevertheless quietly investigated by British authorities to see if there could be any credence to his claims, and ultimately discovered that the letters were being penned by a former policeman by the name of Anthony William Hall. According to the 1901 British Census, Hall was born in Chiswick, Middlesex, in 1898. To Ambrose and Mary Hall, his father's occupation being entered in the document as a retired master mariner. After serving in the Great War, Hall returned to England, quickly got married and joined the Shropshire Police Constabulary, where he quickly worked his way up the ranks, impressively becoming a police inspector at the age of just 28. However, following a heated argument with his chief constable 2 years later, Hall, who was evidently an impetuous fellow, abruptly resigned from the force and moved his family to Quebec, Canada. The move abroad was an unhappy one for the family. It cost Hall his marriage, and his wife and his daughter returned to England without him the same year. Anthony Hall remained in Canada, where he quickly became a wealthy man after setting up a thriving export business. Following the departure of his wife, it seems that Hall had become much more insular. He'd also developed a sudden and all-consuming fascination in genealogy, becoming obsessively interested in his own family tree, spending vast amounts of money on historical documents, and maintaining a near-constant correspondence with London's Somerset House. Since 1837, the location of the Registrar General of Births, Marriages and Deaths. As a result of all his research, Hall discovered that he was a direct descendant of King Henry VIII by his second wife, Anne Boleyn. According to Hall, this ancestor had been born prior to Henry's divorce from his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. And, since he was born outside wedlock, to avoid embarrassment to the throne, he was summarily spirited away to the home of one of Henry's faithful old retainers, John Hall, and duly brought up as one of his children. To Hall, this meant that the whole royal line that followed was illegitimate, and he, as a direct descendant of Henry VIII, was the true Tudor heir, and consequently, the rightful King of England. There were some minor quibbles with Hall's claim, however. Since, by his own reckoning, his ancestor, now identified as John Hall, was born outside wedlock, it would mean that he would have been illegitimate. Therefore, his claim to the throne would have been passed over in favour of Henry's legitimate children. Which, as history recorded, is precisely what did happen. This is all assuming Hall's ancestor actually existed in the first place, which was by no means clear. Despite this fairly specious reasoning, Hall began to act in a manner more befitting England's most senior royal, and insisted on being addressed as Your Majesty by those he came into contact with. Something that Hall's estranged wife and daughter reputedly had some difficulty coming to terms with. To firm up his claim on the throne, Hall argued that the real James I of England, James VI of Scotland, had been murdered as an infant, and his remains were put to rest in Edinburgh Castle. His throne was later usurped by an impostor and changeling by the name of James Erskine. Hall declared to a large crowd in Birmingham's Bullring that it was clear that Erskine was not the rightful heir to the throne. Not only was he goggle-eyed, but he also had rickety little legs that meant he would have struggled to get on a horse, never mind ride one. It was pretty compelling stuff. Having proved he's an impostor, it is obvious that all the kings who claim and have claimed to be descendants of his are not entitled to their jobs and not of the blood royal. Hall told a slightly baffled crowd in the West Midlands. The king is a German, a purebred German. I want to cut off the king's head. Despite habitually being arrested and being fined for his scandalous language, and then being bound over to keep the peace, King Anthony threw himself into his campaign to have the usurper George V removed from the throne. When King Anthony's first letter to the incumbent monarch went unanswered, he was incensed. When his subsequent 9 letters were also ignored, he became enraged. To his mind, not only was this royal pretender depriving him of his birthright, but he was now denying him an audience. On the 14th of March 1931, Hall held a rally in St. Peter's Square, Hereford, at which he told a rapt audience about his unreturned letters, and called on the king to leave the realm. Later, when he invited questions from the crowd, Hall was asked how he could possibly be claiming the throne when he had an elder brother.
Oh, Hall said, covering quickly.
My elder brother is an invalid and does not make any claim, so I have come forward.
And with that, he quickly shuffled from the podium. If the establishment thought that by ignoring King Anthony that he would just give up and go away, they were wrong. Instead, he notched up his campaign and held a function endorsing his own claim to the throne at the Grosvenor, one of London's most prestigious hotels. Hall followed this up by holding a number of rallies across the UK publicising his cause. Then, amidst the blinking of press photographers' flashbulbs, he registered his Royal Tudor Manifesto with the Royal College of Arms, publicly outlining the changes he would make to British law once he succeeded to the throne. Evidently, King George V was aware of the royal claimant's machinations. In a letter to the government, Sir Clive Wigram, his secretary, wrote,
"His Majesty quite agrees that a stop should be put to Hall's effusions, but feels like it might not look very well for a man who is obviously demented to get 6 months' imprisonment." Would it not be possible to keep him under observation, with a view to his final detention in an institution, without actually putting him in prison?
The letter was responded to by Sir John Anderson of the Home Office, who explained that whilst Hall was eccentric and wrong-headed, he wasn't actually mad, and therefore the matter could not really be dealt with without recourse to court proceedings. Most of the constitutional changes Hall proposed seemed to be based on his ideas of Merry Old England. You know, the Tudor period. And involved doing away with such modern aberrations as income tax and death duties. Hall pledged to establish a Ministry of Pleasure, redeem national debt, which had recently peaked above the 7 billion mark, increase the strength of beer, and open up the grounds of royal palaces to the public, so that his subjects could use them for picnics. Despite these populist policies, it seemed very few people took Hall seriously. Undeterred, he relocated to London, buying a mansion outside Finsbury Park, and spent a cool £20,000, about £1.4 million in modern money, at a Bond Street jeweller to make him a ceremonial mace and an official crown, studded with precious stones. Following the death of King George V in 1936, Hall decided it was time to ramp up his campaign, buying an even grander mansion and having a printing press installed in the basement. Here he started churning out his own King Anthony currency. These £1 notes bore an image of his own face peering haughtily out of them, and bore his signature as Master of the Mint. He sold these at his various rallies for a shilling, promising buyers that they would be redeemed at their full face value once he'd been instated as king. Though Hall had long been viewed in official channels as a rather extraordinary and annoyingly well-financed crank, when he announced his plan to hold up the coronation of King George VI, a decidedly dimmer view was taken by government officials. Still courting the press, the enterprising Hall publicly issued a formal challenge to the king's champion, part of the coronation service, which, if he won, would allow him to claim the throne. Two Scotland Yard police detectives were quickly dispatched to Hall's home in an effort to encourage him to drop the challenge. They were apparently convincing. Hall spent his last days squabbling with his sister over a slightly more prosaic claim to his mother's house. The case went to court and the judge ruled in favour of the sister, allowing her the right to evict him. He was still fighting the judge's decision when he passed away in 1947 at the age of just 53. Rather than a full state funeral, Hall was buried in his family's plot in Little Dewchurch, Herefordshire, beneath an unassuming headstone that read simply, Anthony William Hall. Presumably, it was not what he would have wanted.
Next on The English Eccentric.
The Woman of the Apocalypse.
Psst, over here. Hello, it's E.O. Higgins here. Or Edward, my friends. I'm joking, of course. I don't have any friends. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the English eccentric and my magnificent brown tones. If you fancied supporting the podcast, there are several ways you can. You can follow it on Facebook and Twitter at Fogg's Beef and Beer. Or you could write a review wherever you download your podcasts. You can even follow the Patreon by going to www.englishexcentric.co.uk, where you'll get early access to episodes, exclusive content, and the opportunity to suggest subjects for future shows. And if you didn't like it, you know, don't listen. In next week's episode of The English Eccentric, I'll be discussing a woman who famously didn't give birth to the new Messiah, who did get name-checked in a novel by Charles Dickens,
and did get her box manhandled by a famous psychic investigator. Stay tuned.